This is the way the book starts. The difference from a person and an angel is easy. Most of an angel is on the inside, and most of a person is on the outside. These are the words of a six-year-old Anna, sometimes called Mouse, Hum, or Joy. At 5 years, Anna knew absolutely the purpose of being, knew the meaning of love, and was a personal friend and helper of Mr. God. At six, Anna was a theologian, mathematician, philosopher, poet, and gardener. If you ask her a question, you would always get an answer in due course. On some occasions, the answer would be delayed for weeks or months, but eventually, in her own good time, the answer would come, direct, simple, and much to the point. She never made 8 years. She died by an accident. She died with a grin on her beautiful face. She died saying, "I bet Mr. God lets me into heaven for this, and I'll bet he did, too." I knew Anna for just 3.5 years. Some people lay claim to fame by being the first person to sail around the world alone, or to stand on the moon, or by some other act of bravery. All the world has heard of such people. Not many people have heard of me, but I too have a claim to fame, for I knew Anna. To me, this was the high peak of adventure. This was no casual knowing. It required total application, for I knew her on her own terms, the way she demanded to be known. From the inside first. Most of an angel is in the inside. And this is the way I learned to know her, my first angel. Since then, I have learned to know two other angels, but that's another story. And he goes on to say his name's Finn and so forth. But then, says, my great delight was to roam about Dockland in the nighttime, particularly if it was foggy. And this goes to tell how he met her. My life with Anna began at such a night. I was 19 at the time, prowling the streets and alleys with my usual supply of hot dogs. The street lights with their foggy halos showing dark formless shapes moving out from the darkness of the fog and disappearing again. Down the street a little way, a baker's shop window softened and warmed the raw night and its gas lamps. Sitting on the grating under the window was a little girl. In those days, children wandering the streets at night were no uncommon sight. I had seen such things before, but on this occasion it was different. How or why it was different has long since forgotten, except that I am sure it was different. I sat down beside her on the grating, my back against the shop front. We stayed there about 3 hours, looking back over 30 years, I can now cope with those 3 hours. But at the time, I was on the verge of being destroyed. That November night was pure hell. My guts tied themselves into all manner of complicated knots. Perhaps even then, something of an angelic nature caught hold of me. I'm quite prepared to believe that I had been bewitched from the beginning. I sat down with, "Shove up a bit, Titch." She shoved up a bit, then made no comment. "Have a hot dog," I said. She shook her head and answered, "It's yours." "I got plenty. Besides, I'm full up," I said. She made no sign, so I put the bag on the grating between us. The light from the shop window wasn't very strong, and the kid was sitting in the shadow, so I couldn't see what she looked like, except that she was very dirty. I could see that she clutched under one arm a rag doll, and on her lap a battered old paint box. We sat there for 30 minutes or so in complete silence. During that time, I thought there had been a movement of her hand toward the hot dog bag, but I didn't want to look or comment in case I put her off. Even now, I can feel the immense pleasure I had when I heard the sound of a hot dog skin popping under the bite of her teeth. A minute or two later, she took a second and a third. I reached into my pocket and brought out a pocket of woodbines. "Do you mind if I smoke while you're eating, Titch, I asked. "What?" She sounded a little alarmed. "Can I have a cigarette while you're eating?" She rolled over and got to her knees and looked me in the face. "Why?" she said. "My mum's a stickler for politeness. Besides, you don't blow smoke in a lady's face when she's eating," I said. She stared at half a hot dog for a moment or two and looked at me fully and said, "Why, do you like me?" I nodded. "You have a cigarette then," and she smiled at me and popped the rest of the hot dog into her mouth. I took out a woodbine and lit up and offered her the match to blow out. She blew, and I was sprayed with bits of hot dog. This little accident produced such a reaction in her that I felt I had been stabbed in the guts. I had seen a dog cringe before, but never a child. The look she gave me filled me with horror. She expected a thrashing. She clenched her teeth as she waited for me to strike her. What my face registered, I don't know. Perhaps anger and violence or shock and confusion. Whatever it was, it produced from her the most piteous whimper I can describe. I can't describe the sound after all these years. No words are fitting. The feeling I can still taste, can still experience. My heart faltered at the sound, and something came undone inside me. My clenched fist hit the pavement beside me, a useless gesture in response to Anna's fears. Did I think of that image then, that image that I now think of, the only one that fits the occasion? That perfection of violence, that ultimate horror and bewilderment of Christ crucified, that terrible sound that the child made was a sound that I never wish to hear again. It attacked my emotional being and blew a fuse. After a moment or two, I laughed. I suppose that the human mind can only stand so much grief and anguish. After that, the fuses blow. With me, the fuses blew in a big way. The next few minutes, I know very little about, except that I laughed and I laughed. Then I realized the kid was laughing too. No shrunken bundle of fear. She was laughing. Kneeling on the pavement and leaning forward, and her face so close to mine and laughing. So very many times in the next 3 years, I heard her laughter. No silver bells of sweet rippling sounds was her laughter, but like a five-year-old's bellow of delight, a cross between a puppy's yelp, a motorbike, and a bicycle pump. I put my hands on her shoulders and held her off at arm's length, and then came that look that is entirely Anna's, mouth wide open, eyes popping out of her head, like a whippet straining at the leash. Every fiber of that little body was vibrating and making a delicious sound. Legs and arms, toes and fingers, the whole of that little body shook and trembled like Mother Earth giving birth to a volcano. And what a volcano was released in that child. Outside that baker's shop in Dockland on a foggy November night, I had the unusual experience of seeing a child born. After the laughter had quieted off a bit, but while her little body was still thrumming like a violin string, she tried to say something, but it wouldn't come out properly. She managed a you. After some little time and a great deal of effort, she managed, "You love me, don't you?" Even if it had not been true, I could not have said no to save my life. True or false, right or wrong, there was only one answer. I said yes. She gave a little giggle and, pointing a finger at me, said, "You love me," and broke into a primitive gyration around the lamppost, chanting, "You love me, you love me, you love me." 5 minutes of this, and she came back and sat down on the grating. "It's nice and warm for your bum, isn't it?" I agreed it was nice for your bum. A moment later, and she talked, he talks then about going out and getting a couple of, he gets her a pop and he gets himself a beer and they proceed to shake the bottle. You remember when we were kids and get themselves wet? And then he takes her home. She won't tell him. He asked her where she lived and she won't tell him because she's afraid that he'll take her back to, she calls it the cop shop. She don't want to go to the cop shop because she knows if she goes to the police station, why they'll just take her back home. Then he asked her how long she'd been gone from home, and she says she'd been gone home for 3 days. Obviously, this wasn't the first time she'd run away from home. It's really hard to know how, for me, to understand how a child like this could have such tremendous insight, but I really wanted to share with you some of the things that she says in the book. And there's an awful lot of he was a mathematician, one of the things. He was also an artist, but one of the other things, he was also an electronics genius, I guess. He liked to work with radios and things like that. So he taught her a lot in that respect, in mathematics, and she picked it up so quickly. But everything that she learned and everything she picked up, she related to Mr. God. Had such a tremendous relationship. Says Mom, who was his mother, and Anna. His mother was very heavy. Mom and Anna shared many likes and dislikes. Perhaps the simplest and most beautiful sharing was her attitude toward Mr. God. Most people I knew used God as an excuse for their failure. He should have done this, or why has God done this to me? But with Mom and Nana, difficulties and adversities were merely occasions for doing something. Ugliness was a chance to make beautiful. Sadness was a chance to make glad. Mr. God was always available to them. A stranger would have been excused for believing that Mr. God lived with us, but then Mom and Nana believed he did. Very rarely did any conversation exclude Mr. God in some way or other. The message of the Bible, and Anna is explaining the message of the Bible from her viewpoint. The message of the Bible was simple. Any half-wit could grasp it in 30 minutes, flat. Religion was for doing things, not for reading about doing things. Once you had got the message, there wasn't much point in going over and over the same ground. And then she has a conversation with the parson. The parson asks her, "Do you believe in God?" "Yes." "Do you know what God is?" "Yes." "What is God then?" "He's God." "Do you go to church?" "No." "Why not?" "Because I know it all." "What do you know?" "I know to love Mr. God and to love people and cats and dogs and spiders and flowers and trees," and the catalog went on, "with all of me." And then he goes on to say, Anna had bypassed all the non-essentials and distilled centuries of learning into one sentence. "And God said, love me, love them, and love it. And don't forget to love yourself." Let's see. One of my particular pleasures was seeing the copper-crowned diminutive child doing her workings out, as she called it, looking down from a height of 6 foot or more and saying, "How do you know, Titch?" I'd see her head screw around and upward and watch one delicious wiggle start from her toes, pass up her body, to be tossed off the top of her head in a foam of silky copper thread with a grin of absolute joy. That seems to be a real good description of everything that she did. It seemed as though everything that she talked about, or anything that she did with complete abandon. Somehow or other, we lose that ability when we grow older. Yeah, she obviously didn't grow old enough to lose that. I suppose Anna had one problem in her little life, a lack of hours per day. There was too much to do, too many exciting things to find out. Another of Anna's magic carpets was the microscope. It revealed a little world made big, a world of intricate shape and pattern, a world of creatures too small to see with the naked eye. Even the very dirt itself was wonderful. Before all this adventuring into these hidden worlds, Mr. God had been Anna's friend and companion. But now, well, this was going a bit too far. If Mr. God had done all this, he was something larger than Hannah had bargained for. It needed a bit of thinking about. "Finn, Mr. God doesn't love us," she hesitated. "He doesn't really, you know. Only people can love. I love Bossy, but Bossy don't love me. I love the Pollywogs, but they don't love me. I love you, Finn, and you love me, don't you?" I tightened my arm around her. "You love me because you are people. I love Mr. God truly, but he don't love me." It sounded to me like a death knell. Damn and blast, I thought. Why does this have to happen to people? Now she's lost everything, but I was wrong. She had got both feet planted firmly on the next stepping stone. "No," she went on, "no, he don't love me. Not like you. Not like you do. It's different. It's a million times bigger." I must have made some movement or noise, for she levered herself upright and sat on her haunches and giggled. Then she launched herself at me and undid my little pang of hurt, cut out the useless spark of jealousy with the delicate sureness of a surgeon. "Finn, you can love better than any people that ever was, and so can I, can't I? But Mr. God is different. You see, Finn, people can only love outside and can only kiss outside, but Mr. God can love you right inside, and Mr. God can kiss you right inside. So it's different. Mr. God ain't like us. We are a little bit like Mr. God, but not much yet." Gone were all the human definitions of God, like goodness, mercy, love, and justice. but these were merely props to describe the indescribable. You see, Finn, Mr. God is different from us because he can finish things and we can't. I can't finish loving you because I shall be dead millions of years before I can finish. But Mr. God can finish loving you, and so it's not the same kind of love, is it? Then she goes on and talks about people having a point of view, and Mr. God having viewing points. I wasn't too sure about that, but I didn't quite understand what she's trying to put across there. But except that Mr. God could see everything. And then she's in the. He takes her to the park, and she's playing in the grass, and doesn't see the keep off the grass sign, so a policeman comes over and tells her that she has to get off the grass. So then she says, talks about those words, like keep off the grass sign, and she says, them words that keep off the grass, them words are like that church we went to this morning. Then it all became apparent. Like the flower beds, the church service had been to Anna nothing less than to a notice saying, keep off the grass. She couldn't get at the best bits. To be inside a church, not at a church service, but simply to be inside, was for Anna like visiting a very, very special friend. And visiting a very special friend is a happy occasion, and that surely is a good enough reason to dance. Inside a church, Anna danced. It was the best bit. Church services, therefore, like the keep off the grass notices, did not allow her to have the best bit. I smiled as I pictured the kind of service that Anna would have liked. I'm not so sure that Mr. God wouldn't have preferred it too. And she says, ain't Mr. God wonderful? Anna was not only deeply in love with Mr. God, she was proud of him. Anna's pride in Mr. God grew and grew to such dimensions that in some idiot moment, I wondered if Mr. God ever went pink with pleasure. Whatever feelings people have had about Mr. God over the centuries, I'm very sure of one thing. Nobody has ever liked Mr. God more than Anna. The instructions weren't to be good and kind and loving and so forth, and it therefore followed that you would be more like Mr. God. No. The whole point of being alive was to be like Mr. God. And then you couldn't help but be good and kind and loving, could you? If you get like Mr. God, you don't know you are, do you? Are what, I questioned, good and kind and loving. This last comment was delivered in her throwaway tone of voice as if it were insignificant and irrelevant. I knew this one of old. Either you had to pretend it hadn't happened or start asking questions. A moment or two of hesitation on my part as I watched the grin spread across from her toes and explode in one short, sharp hoot of mirth, and I realized that she had sprung the trap. She had something to say and had forced me into asking the question. If I hadn't done it, then I would have had to sooner or later. So, okay, Titch, what's all this goodness and kindness and loving, Lark, then? Well, and the tone of her voice slid down the roller coaster of excitement, shot up the other side and took off. Well, if you think you are, you ain't. From all my position at the bottom of this particular class, I asked, how come? I thought I had got the drift of this conversation and reckoned I was waiting for her about two steps ahead. She had signaled a right turn and I was waiting for her, but suddenly she took a left-handed U-turn and sped back against the oncoming arguments. Thrown off balance by the sudden switch, I couldn't do no more than walk back to where she was waiting. Right, give, I said. You don't expect Mr. God knows he is good and kind and loving, do you? This whole book is just full of this stuff. I've only picked a few of the ones that I thought were the most important. And and she mentions Mr. God being empty. And he says, Titch, what's this Mr. God being empty stuff? She turned to me eagerly. I distinctly got the impression that she had waited for this question for days, but could do nothing until I had seen my picture of Mr. God, the great magician. When the world went all red through the bit of glass and the color from the flower, I remembered that all right. We had talked about transmitted light and reflected light, that light took on the color of the glass through which it was transmitted, that the color of the yellow flower was due to reflected light. We had seen the colors of the spectrum with the aid of a prism. We had looked at Newton's colored spinning disk and had mixed all the colors of the spectrum back to white again. I had explained that the yellow flower absorbed all the colors of the spectrum, with the exception of yellow, which was reflected back to the viewer. Anna had digested this bit of information for a while and then had come back with, "Oh, yellow is a bit it don't want," and after a pause, "So its real color is all the bits it do want." I couldn't argue that this with this, since I couldn't be sure what the heck a flower would want anyway. All these bits of information had been taken in, mixed with various bits of colored glass, shaken well, and worked into her particular framework. It seemed that each and every individual was issued at birth with various bits of glass labeled good, bad, nasty, and so forth. People got into the habit of slipping these bits of glass over their inward eye and seeing things according to the color and label of the glass. This we did, I was given to understand, in order to justify our inner convictions. You couldn't say the same thing about Mr. God. Mr. God wanted everything, so he didn't reflect anything back. Now, if Mr. God didn't reflect anything back, we couldn't possibly see him, could we? So as far as we are concerned, so far as we were able to understand what Mr. God was, we simply had to admit that Mr. God was quite empty. Not empty because there was truly nothing there, but empty because he accepted everything, because he wanted everything and did not reflect anything back. Of course, you could cheat if you wanted to, and you could wear your bit of colored glass marked Mr. God is loving, or the bit marked Mr. God is kind, but then, of course, you would miss the whole nature of Mr. God. Just imagine what kind of an object Mr. God must be if he accepts everything, if he reflects absolutely nothing back. This, said Anna, is being a real God. This is what we were being asked to do. Throw away our pieces of colored glass and see clearly. Now, he uses the word missable. I don't know what that word is. I've never heard that word before. But it may be an English word that I don't understand. But he talks about missable because it is too damned expensive. Missable because the price is not being frightened. Of night being frightened is trust. And what a word that is. Define it how you like, and I'll bet you'll miss the main point. It's more than confidence, more than security. It doesn't belong to ignorance, or for that matter, to knowledge either. It is simply the ability to move out of the I'm the center of things and to let something or someone take over. And as for Anna, she had simply moved out and let Mr. God move in. I'd known about this for a long time. Now, on one occasion, I was holding it. He was holding two circles so that they were at right angles, like this Chinese game with the two rings that are in, and you tried to get them apart. And he says, on one occasion, I was holding these two circles, so they stood at right angles to each other. Anna pointed to one of the circles and said, "I know what that is. That's me." "And that's Mr. God," she said, pointing to the other. "Mr. God goes right through my middle, and I go through right through Mr. God's middle." And that's how it was. Anna had grasped that her proper place was in God's middle, and that God's proper place was in her middle. It's really hard, as I say, to believe this is true, because it's so profound. Anna had come to the conclusion that in the realm of numbers, there was one number which was far more important than any other number. This was the number one, important because any other number could be made up by adding sufficient numbers of ones. True, there was a tricky way out. And then he goes on to explain. It says, but like numbers, words also had a most important word. And this word, naturally enough, was God. Anna saw the most important number one as the apex of a triangle. Only her triangle was standing on its apex. Number one had to bear the weight of all the other numbers. So we always put God on the top like this, and she just turned the triangle upside down and put God on the bottom so that he was, all of us were on his shoulders, which is a quite interesting concept, which means that we really don't have to reach up here someplace into the stratosphere. Anna showed me her workings out. One sheet contained an upside-down triangle standing on the point labeled 1. This was the number, numbers triangle. One sheet showed a triangle standing on the point labeled God. And the last sheet in the shoebox showed a triangle standing on the point marked Anna. Ha, I said. You've got a triangle all to your triangle all to yourself, I see. No, everybody has got one. Oh, what's it mean then? It's for when I die, and Mr. God asked me all them questions. What about it? Well, I've got to answer them all by myself. Nobody can do it for me. I see. But what does the triangle mean? That I have got to be responsible, I suggested. Yes, responsible. Yes, I see. You mean you've got to bear all the weight like those other triangles do? Yes, of the things I've done and the things I've thought. Each word was underlined with a nod of satisfaction. She left me in the silence of her full stop. It took a little time for all this to sink in, but it was true. We've all got to bear the weight of our own actions. We've all got to be responsible, either now or later. We've got to answer Mr. God's questions all by ourselves. And then he kind of reflects on his last few years with Anna. And it says here, there was no doubt about it. Anna's arrival had caused a fair degree of upheaval in the house, given me lots of problems to deal with, and caused a lot of heartache. From the very beginning, I had seen her as someone who was a little unusual. Perhaps it had just been the unusual way we had met. The first few weeks had shown me that she was certainly no baby angel, no changeling, in fact, not even a sprite. No, she was at least 100% child, complete with the giggles, dirty face, and breathless wonder. She went flat out after each day, as busy as a bee, as inquisitive as a kitten, and as playful as a puppy. We knew that Mr. God had made man in his own image. He taught her about mirrors and reflections. And in fact, they went down to the five and dime store and bought about 10 mirrors and put them all together in different configurations until they made all kinds of little, they'd put things inside of a box and look in a peephole and to see what kind of images they could see. And says, we knew that Mr. God had made man in his own image. So could it be? Was it possible? And then she says, he might have made a big mirror, Finn. What would he want to do that for? I don't know, but he might have. Could be. Perhaps we're on the other side. How come the other side? Perhaps we're on the wrong way, or we're the wrong way around. That's a thought, Titch. That's why we get it all wrong. Yeah, that's why we get it all wrong. Like numbers? Like numbers. Like numbers? Yeah, the numbers in the mirror. How's that? Them numbers in the mirror, them numbers is takeaway numbers, not add numbers. Don't get you, Titch. What you driving at? Anna took a paper and pencil and wrote 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Them is add numbers, she pronounced. If you put a looking glass on 0, then the numbers came out 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. They're takeaway numbers. I was following the argument so far. The reflected numbers were takeaway numbers. She continued, people were takeaway people. Hold it, I put out my hand. I don't get this takeaway stuff. And then she goes on and she stacks up books, and the books on the table were add books, and then when she knocks the books off the table, she calls those takeaway books. They're just where the books are no longer there on the table. The whole is the... And then He goes on to say, it's all pretty obvious, so obvious that it would take an idiot not to see it. We all know that Mr. God made man in his own image, and images are found in mirrors. Mirrors turn you back to front or left to right. Images were take away things. So putting it all together, Mr. God was and Mr. God is on one side of the mirror. Mr. God was on the ad side. We were on the other side of the mirror. So we were on the takeaway side. We ought to have known that. When Mum puts the toddler down and backs off a few paces, she does so in order to encourage the toddler to walk to her. So did Mr. God. Mr. God puts you down on the takeaway side of the mirror and asks you to find your way to the ad side of the mirror. You see, he wants you to be like him. Takeaway people live in holes. Must do, I admitted. What sort of holes? Different holes. Ah, well, that accounts for it. How are they different? Some big, some little, she continued, all with different names. Different names such as... She walked around the holes, reading off the names as she went. Greedy, wicked, cruel, liar, etc. and so forth. On our side of the looking glass, the whole world is littered with holes of various depths with people living at the bottom. On Mr. God's side were appropriate piles of whatever, ready to fill up the holes, if only we got the sense to ask for them. The piles also have names like generosity, kindness, and truth. The more you fill up your hole, the nearer to Mr. God's side of the mirror you got. And this is kind of the way most of us, his description of the way, or her description of the way most of us understand Mr. God. When you're little, you understand Mr. God. He sits up there on his throne, a golden throne, of course. He has got whiskers and a crown, and everything is singing hymns like mad to him. Everyone is singing hymns like mad to him. God is useful and usable. You can ask him for things. He can strike your enemies deader than a doornail, and he is pretty good at putting hexes on the bully next door, like warts and things. Mr. God is so understandable, so useful, and so usable, he is like some object, perhaps the most important object of all, but nevertheless an object and absolutely understandable. Later on, you understand him to be a bit different, but you are still able to grasp what he is. Even though you understand him, he doesn't seem to understand you. He doesn't seem to understand that you simply must have a new bike. So your understanding of him changes a bit more. In whatever way or state you understand Mr. God, so you diminish his size. He becomes an understandable entity among other understandable entities. So Mr. God keeps on shedding bits all the way through your life until the time comes when you admit freely and honestly that you don't understand Mr. God at all. At this point, you have let Mr. God be his proper size, and wham, there he is, laughing at you. Getting close to the end here. He's talking about, he calls old Satan old Nick. This is pretty good here. And old Nick, how did he get in? What's his name? Satan? Another one, the devil. No, another one. Finally, I hit on Lucifer. Yes, what's it mean? Light, I think. How about Jesus? Yeah, how about Jesus? What's he say? Lots of things, I suppose. What did he call himself? The Good Shepherd? Something else. Or the Way? Something else. Oh, you mean the Light. Yes. Old Nick and Jesus, both the Light. You know what Jesus said, don't you? I am the Light. She stressed the word I. What did he say it like that for? So you don't get muddled. How do you get muddled? Two kinds of light, a pretend one and a real one, Lucifer and Mr. God. They're in church. She has a hard time in church, and of course the pastor doesn't like her at all because she's always making comments that he doesn't agree with, but this Reverend Castle. But he's talking about meeting God face to face. And she whispers rather loudly so that everybody can, at least the pastor can hear that God ain't got no face. So he talks about not being able to turn around, and it says, on our way home from church, I asked her what she had meant by, He don't have to turn around. Well, she said, I've got an in front and I've got a behind, so I have to turn around to see what's behind me. Mr. God don't. What's he do then, I asked. Mr. God's only got an in front. He don't have no behind. Oh, I nodded, I see. The idea of Mr. God having no behind struck me as deliciously funny, and I tried hard to suppress the giggles. I didn't manage it. I exploded. Anna was a bit puzzled at my outburst. What you laughing for, she asked. Just the idea of Mr. God having no behind, I chortled. Her eyes narrowed for a moment or two, and then she grinned. The grin fanned her eyes into flame, and she lit up like a Roman candle. He ain't got one of them, too. Her laughter ran along the road, erecting little barricades as it went. The all-too-obvious and self-satisfied Christian worshippers bumped into the laughter and frowned. Mr. God ain't got no bum, asked Anna, sang Anna to the tune of Onward Christian Soldiers. See, as the people walking along the street looked in horror and said, disgusting, little savage, a limb of Satan. So on our homeward journey, Anna practiced her newly discovered game with me in the same manner that she launched her spiritual being at Mr. God. So she launched her physical being at me. Mr. God ain't got no bum. It wasn't a joke. She wasn't being naughty or just a silly child. It was just an eruption of her spirit. With these remarks, she hurled herself at Mr. God, and he caught her. Anna knew that he could, knew that there was no risk involved. There was really no other way. It just had to be done. This was her way of being saved. Her game with me was similar. She would stand some distance off, run toward me, and launch herself at me. The run toward me was deliberate and active. The moment after her launch, she was completely passive and limp. She made no effort to help me catch her, no effort toward her own safety. Being safe meant not doing these things at all. Being saved meant trusting in another. Being safe was easy. You simply accepted Mr. God as a Superman who hadn't shaved for about 6 months or so. That angels looked like men and women with wings on, and that cherubs looked like fat little babies with wings that couldn't support a sparrow, let alone 25 pounds or more of chubby infant. No, being saved was for Anna only possible in that act of creative violence in the images of being safe. Every minute of every day Anna lived, she totally accepted her life, and in accepting life, accepted death. Death was a fairly frequent topic of conversation with Anna. Never morbid or anxious, simply something that would happen at some time or other. And it was better to have some grasp of it before it happened than to wait until the moment of death and then get panicky about it. For Anna, death was a gateway to possibilities. It was Mum who provided Anna with the solution to the problem of death. Like Anna, Mum had this lovely gift of asking questions that landed somewhere. What, she asked on one Sunday afternoon, was God's greatest creative act? And then he tries to guess right on down the line to the, you know, 6 days of creation. And Anna finally figures out that it wasn't any of those, that it was the seventh day. Of course it was, the seventh day. And he argues with her and says that he didn't do anything on the seventh day. And, yes, he did. He didn't rest because he was tired. He created the seventh day to create rest. And he said he made rest. And, yes, that's the biggest miracle. Rest is, what do you think it was like before Mr. God started on the first day? A perishing big muddle, I guess, I replied. Yes, and you can't rest when everything is in a big muddle, can you? I suppose not. So what then? Well, when he started to make all the things, it got a bit less muddly. Makes sense, I nodded. When he had finished making all the things, Mr. God had undone all the muddle, then you can rest. So that's why rest is a very, very, very special, biggest miracle of all, don't you see? Then she says, it ain't, said Anna, you have to have a muddle in your head before you really know what rest is. Dying could be a bit of a problem, but not if you really lived. Dying needed a certain amount of preparation, and the only preparation for dying was real living. And as it says in the beginning of the book, she died by an accident. And but here is, I've got on the side here, Anna's Love. I've got it in red and marked real plainly. Finn, I love you. When Anna said that, every word was shattered by the fullness of meaning she packed into it. Her I was totality. Whatever this I was for Anna was packed tight with being. Like the light that didn't fray, Anna's I didn't fray either. It was pure and all of one piece. Her use of the word love was not sentimental or mushy. It was impelling and full of courage and encouragement. For Anna, love meant the recognition of perfectibility in another. Anna saw a person in every part. Anna saw a you. Now that is something to experience, to be seen as a you, clearly and definitely with no parts hidden, wonderful and frightening. Anna's efforts were directed to being like Mr. God, so perhaps the trick is catching, if only you can try hard enough. You could, if you wished, deny that Mr. God existed, but then any denial didn't alter the fact that Mr. God was. No, Mr. God was. He was the kingpin, the center, the very heart of things. And this is where it got funny. You see, we had to recognize that he was all these things, and that meant that we were at our own center, not God. God is our center, and yet it is we who acknowledge that he is the center. That makes us somehow internal to Mr. God. This is the curious nature of Mr. God, that even while he is at the center of all things, he waits outside us and knocks to come in. It is we who open the door. Mr. God doesn't break it down and come in. No, he knocks and waits. How many of you all have the feeling that this is not true? How could anybody have that kind of insight, you know? At that age, especially, it's just, I don't know how many times I've read this book over and over, and I keep remarking some places that I hadn't marked before. And maybe this will be the last little bit here. It says, Finn, Mr. God said, I am. And that's what he wants us all to say. That's the hard bit. My head went up and down in a bewildered agreement. I am. That's the hard bit. I am. I am. Really get around to saying that and you're home. Really mean it and you're full up. You're all inside. You don't have to want things outside. You want to fill up the gaps inside you. And don't leave bits of you hanging around on objects in shop windows and catalogs or in advertising hoardings. Wherever you go, and wherever you go, you take your whole self with you, and don't leave bits lying around to get stamped on. You're all of a piece. You're what Mr. God wants you to be, and I am like he is. Hell's bells, all this time I thought that going to church was in order to look for God, for praising him. It didn't dawn on me that what Mr. God was doing. All this time he had been working overtime trying to knock a bit of sense into my noodle, trying to turn an it is into an I am. And I finally got the message. I encourage you to read it. It's one of the most exciting books I've ever read. So.
When was it written? When was it copied?
Doesn't even say, I think. Yeah, it does. The first one was 74. Copyright 74. Yeah, actually, to me, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, whether he's saying it or whether Anna's saying it or who's saying it really doesn't make any difference, because it strikes so many bells with me that it would be immaterial to me. it's, you know, I guess the part that I have so much trouble with is that I have never seen anybody like that, so it's hard to relate. Maybe it's, you know, it's kind of hard for me sometimes to relate to people like St. Francis too, because I've never seen anybody like St. Francis. Read about him, never seen anybody. Or Paul, or, you know, any of the disciples. Never really seen anybody like that. So it's hard to relate. But the truth, that does not alter the truth. Just like she says, or he says, you know, that whether we believe in God or not doesn't alter the fact that God exists. We have a choice. We can decide whether we believe in God or whether we don't, but that doesn't change the fact. And we can say that electricity doesn't exist too, but it doesn't change the fact that the lights are on, and somehow or other there's something going through the wires causing those lights to burn.
Well, I think maybe the part that's believable is if you have to think of kids, little kids, and their theology that they come up with, even if they haven't been taught these things, but they have explanations, and it's just marvelous. It's sad that we can't record them all and remember the things that they say.
Yeah, it's sad that it's even sadder that we lose that spontaneity that they seem to have. I mean, Claire is a shining example of some of that. Sure, she hollers and screams and gets mad at her sister and things like that, but some of the other things that she comes up with are just phenomenal.
Has the guy written other, his author written other?
As far as I know, he hasn't. And he doesn't give us any name but just Finn. In the beginning, he says that of course he has another name, but everybody's always called him Finn, so that's what it's on the, it just says, "Mr. God, this is Anna by Finn." So Marjorie Holmes, I'm sure all of you heard of Marjorie Holmes, quite a writer. She says, "Absolutely irresistible, a book I'll be urging other people to read the rest of my life." And I'll never forget, when I was here two summers ago, there was a young girl who'd come up on the boat with us and was here for, she worked over in Narnia, I think she was here for 3 weeks. Before she left, I gave her one of these books, and she wrote to us about a month or two later and said that she read the book and got so excited about it that she just gave it to her friend, who gave it to another friend, who just passed it on and on. And that, to me, is exciting, because, you know, this, if we could somehow grasp with the excitement that she had who God is in our relationship, I think we could forget about all the other things. We could just, like, who was it? Martin Luther said, "Love God and sin boldly," or something like that. And, you know, if we really love God with the true love that He wants us to, then everything that we would do would be to His glory, and we wouldn't have to worry. But we have so many things holding us back, it seems like. Her problem with the Sunday school teacher was that the Sunday school teacher made God too small.
Yeah.
And that was what J.B. Phillips says, "Your God is too small." Of course, we all put God in a box. You know, some of us put God in a church building. In other words, God can't be anywhere else. We have to have special things that happen in church, and out here, other things happen. In other words, there's so much separation, and yet there shouldn't be, because God's created the whole vastness, everything. We've created the buildings. In fact, there's a friend of mine who's an engineer in San Diego said, "In nature, there are no straight lines. Only man created the straight lines." I'd never thought about it before he mentioned that, but it's true.